Well, after that wonderful exploratory canter around the culture of suburbia and first half of this afternoon, taking in some dystopian visions of a romantic Arcady and some racing terms of realism, much in the spirit sometimes seemed to me of that eminent novelist of suburbia, J.G. Ballard, whose dark imaginings came out of Shepperton. We now move on to the second half, and a consideration of the implications of building perhaps more homes in the suburbs, and the implications of that for our creative industries. And who better to start this discussion than Ed Vasey, Minister of State for Culture, Communications and the Creative Industries. There are those who regard Ed as the epitome of the metropolitan milieu, slipping along predestined grooves from the Arcady of West London to the Elysium of Westminster. But how long can they be? Because as a Member of Parliament, he represents a quintessential aspect of rural England and Oxfordshire, but it also incorporates Didcot, which may indeed have its own capacity for suburban excitements of various kinds. He's a man of broad vision, generous sympathies, and quintessentially well-informed about these aspects of the media life. And he is going to be starting our discussion this afternoon, after which I'll be handing over to Crispin Kelly, whose idea was originally that we should devote this afternoon to the question of suburbs, and who has had a benign curatorial influence on our discussions and on our planning. But we'll kick off, really, with Ed, who will tell us what he thinks about the ever-changing cultural scene along the margins, the limines, London and its suburbs. Ed Vasey.
Right, well, I didn't know I was talking about that. But I will now show you the supreme talents of a politician of 9 years' standing. There's a bit of a metaphor for where I'm sitting, as I've been moved from the far left to the centre. But I had to fight Rupert for my seat, Rupert being a Labour candidate as well as representing Kingston University, but I had to fight her off, and I've got the seat, at least for this session. She may take it off me later on. It is true that I represent Didcot, and if you're talking about culture in the suburbs and Didcot, Didcot was until recently the home of the world's largest Henry Moore sculpture. I am, of course, referring to Didcot Power Station, whose cooling towers were laid out by Henry Moore. And unfortunately, a couple of months ago, three of them were blown down, and the rest are going to be blown down in the next couple of years. I'm also here because I talk a lot about urban policy to James Fishless, who you're going to hear from later on. So I wanted to come and listen to what James had to say. And in terms of the work I do, in terms of urban policy and the future of suburbs and planning, I'm really an interloper. I appreciate what Hal indicated about the importance of culture, which I'm also happy to talk about. But I stray into a lot of areas that are really not my business. And I do it because I have this culture brief, and because culture is all-pervasive, it allows me to range far and wide. And one of the ways I did that was by asking Terry Farrell to do a review of architecture policy, because I'm nominally the Minister for Architecture as one of the creative industries. But obviously, once we spent time looking at skills and education and so on, really, it came down to a debate, as it always does, about planning, the role, the relationship between architecture and town planning. I think this is at the heart of what we're talking about, because clearly what is of central importance in this debate, certainly from a politician's perspective, is this squaring of the circle. The need for more housing, but at the same time the quite legitimate concerns of people to preserve their quality of life. And I think I see it from every perspective, working in central London, having grown up in a suburb in Chiswick, and representing a seat which is predominantly rural in character, where people are very concerned about losing, I think quite legitimately, very concerned about losing their rural identity. I also think we're at a particularly interesting point, both in terms of policy and what is actually happening in reality. Obviously, this government, with its neighbourhood plans and its desires to involve the community in planning, I think, is a very good thing. One hopes it works in practice, but certainly I think that one of the things we've learned from the last sort of 30 or 40 years is the need to, I think, involve communities. People are now much more sophisticated and wanting to become engaged. But also I think in London we see a very successful city, actually, across the political divide in terms of the leadership that London has had and the investment that has gone into making this city work in terms of, particularly in terms of transport. And I think there is a greater focus now on cities and the leadership of cities, particularly the success of the institution. I happen to think the success of the institution of the London Mayor, and a movement towards getting more leadership in cities outside London, and a focus on the benefits of living in cities in terms of sustainability and the environment. And I think this seminar is so important because that focus needs to be balanced against the development of the suburb and how that fits in, alongside as well the other new development which is emerging, which is the kind of reimagination of the garden city, led by people like Lord Wolfson and others, in terms of how to square that circle. So there's a lot going on. I think culture sits at the heart of this as well, and I think that one thing that makes a successful city in particular is culture and the opportunity for people to live in a place which has a lot going on, a lot to see and do. The other part of my brief, which is technology, also I think is very, very important for this debate about planning urban versus suburban, or urban and suburban. The Internet of Things, smart cities, all of this that I'm involved in, using technology to make cities work better, is also, I think, an important element of this debate. So those are just a few random thoughts. I think Howell, you know, tried to corral me down a particular road. I don't know whether I stuck to the path that he lit up for me or whether I strayed too widely. But I've tried at least to speak some genuine thoughts about things that go around in my head, but I'm particularly looking forward to the contributions of our speakers. So I'll shut up.
Thank you very much. It's very broad the way it can be characterised. It's a nervous effect, as I expected. Christopher, over to you as the moderator of this.
Thank you, Hal. Thank you very much for you know, hosting this event, which I think is splendid. And I think talking about suburbia is a very unrepresented subject, so I'm very happy to be here, and thank you very much. Ed also, I think, has forgotten the last time that we met, which was about 8 years ago.
I'm worried about this.
When we went together to Blackheath.
Oh, of course.
And he had, I think I had contacted you and said, look, I'd like to show you some good architecture in suburban situations. And how can we do more of this? And he very gamely came to Blackheath to look at a span development, Corner Green, which many of you may know. But I think it's a sort of a tribute to your interest that you're willing to come to Blackheath and check it out. And I think this morning, the earlier session today was quite extraordinary in the sort of vigour of people's opinions and people's interest in the subject of how we can best live in a prosperous way. You know, is it the sort of the Rive Gauche which wants to be dense, or are we more private and want to be in the suburbs, or is in fact privacy in the city? So I think it's a tremendously interesting subject, and very pleased to be able to introduce Fred Manson as our first speaker. And Fred's somebody I've known for many years, and I'm sure many of you know of him by reputation, and I'm looking forward to what he has to say.
I'm going to talk about infrastructure, which determines the future shape of the city, and that it is infrastructure which really does set out the regime. I thought I would demonstrate this by the first part of this is sitting in the suburban area in the back of the room, so that I wasn't here at the middle of the table, but in the back, and listening to the people in the center talking about what they want to talk about. And that sort of separation is really, really clear in cities. The infrastructure was really easy to see until you had private cars. There were train lines which went out. There it was. The houses went along those. every piece of infrastructure expanded the city. When the car came, there was total confusion. And it changed the whole understanding of what was a city, because there were ways of being in a city and separate from it. As we know, some people have told me today that Kentish Town is a suburb. Others have talked about other parts of these which are way before the car came in. So the suburban concept was certainly around for a very, very long time. It was Andrew Saint who unfortunately said exactly what I thought was really good about what suburbs did. Busy people of moderate means may live, rarefied but also democratized, in the suburbs. And there you have it all, that it was an ambitious step to move into a suburb. It was democratized by finding you were going to share things with each other. And it was a way of living which people chose. And that is the incredibly important thing. Unfortunately, I have to say about the Urban Task Force, it started with the premise that there was nothing at all but the city. And the city was the sole description of the way that people could live. And there was no imagination that there was any other way for a person to carry on. I looked up the index in the report, and there are four references in the several hundred pages to the suburbs. And they couldn't really deal with it. When I used to ask questions to them, at that time there was something called the Countryside Commission, and there was the Urban Task Force. Were they going to do a suburban task force? And no one could quite really answer that question. However, things started to change. I first saw it in Brent. And you then started to see that there were real social problems in the suburbs. What had happened? Those proud owner-occupiers had moved out. And indifferent landlords had come in. The houses were now split into several units, and there was therefore no private space. And they all of a sudden discovered that there was no public space. The schools began to have to cope with things. It was not a calm group of people, but people with great difficulties. And the suburb, in the end, didn't work. I would assert that the suburb is a very fragile typology, and it really depends upon everybody having more or less the same income, more or less the same sort of objectives, and that you live happily together because you're forced to live together in a way which is not perhaps true in the city. But suburbs have always changed. I've talked about one of the changes recently, but there were amazing changes in the past. I rather like it. It's an urban rather than a suburban example, but there's a town, Morris Beresford, going around trying the lost towns of Britain. A church was built, and of course the church stays, but the new town, as they built things, would build next to the one here. And now, the small village is 2 miles from the church. In over 500 years, the town itself has moved that distance. I think we're in a temptation of wanting the city to change, but the suburb to stay the same. And we're not accepting that what has happened. Your statistics about sort of people, you've gone, the guy from the government, about moving into suburbs is absolutely
the
right.
The other guy, number 10. Yeah. And the important one's gone.
He was a civil servant. And it is absolutely right that there's a great number of people who go into the suburbs. And we who are urbanites have no understanding of why a person might decide that I would like to go and live in a suburb. And in return, I think they are completely and deeply confounded by the way we talk as urbanites. And the suggestion is the only way of dealing with it is to eradicate the other side. And I'm suggesting that we don't need to go quite that far. Perhaps not that far at all. I'm going to end on talking about a report that the GLA commissioned in 2010. I've dropped my speaker. It was called High Street London, and it was an incredibly interesting study. It showed that there are something like 600 places which could be called high streets. They were spread throughout all of London. This then took out the central activity zone in the middle and looked at the rest of the area and came up with some really interesting numbers. The central area zone has 33.2% of the total number of employees. The areas within 200 metres of these high streets have 34.8. That is more than the whole of central London. of the employers outside the center zone, we've left them out now, 51% of those were employed in places that were within 200 meters of high streets. If you then go on to the unbelievably complicated system of SLARS, which I'm sure you all know means strategic housing land availability, 55% of those are within 200 meters of high streets. I would assert that we don't have a uniform suburb, but we have high streets. And if you also look at the high streets, there are 6 tube stations in London which do not go to a high street. All the others actually end up at a high street. They are struggling. Yes, they are not as happy as they might have been before, but they still are the identity for an area. They still are the places where people associate and think about them, and they are deeply important bits about transport. I did say that the city is determined by infrastructure. And I am suggesting that instead of having new ideas about thinking about additional infrastructure, let us look at the infrastructure that we have at present and let us think how that might be used in different ways. I also worked with the GLA on a study where we were looking at what you could do about building near town centres. To my deep regret, I can't tell you the important fact, but what we found out was that if we looked at the capacity within town centres or high streets, we could provide all the growth that was then needed for London just in those areas. The fact that I can't tell you, which I would like to, is whether that was at a lower density, a medium density, or a higher density. But as I recall, and it was about 8 years ago, it was at a medium density, probably just about enough to allow people to have a garden, probably an important point. So I'm wondering whether if I started this idea, we might have something that we could work on that would be a way of moving into a new era. This would suggest that the suburbs are going to change, but not beyond definition. It would also suggest the reasonable challenge about politics and social issues and, of course, economics, to think a new way about suburbs. So this is my new game, not entirely developed, but I'll share it with you, as we say. I suggest we concentrate the growth in the high street areas. These are the 600 ones that we found. We assess the capacity of each high street for its transport capacity, its education capacity, that is the existing infrastructure. We also assess the available land. And I think we're going to find that most of that is going to be within these areas. There's also another interesting study that was done, that 45% of the land which is said to be vacant in the city is actually not owned by someone who wants to build on it, and therefore they are not interested in building, which reduces dramatically the number of houses by taking other factors into account instead of a potential of 210,000 down to 50,000. But most of those sites which are marginal are in areas which are called high streets. Then, very importantly, we think about the places that we want to create. We make the urban structure along the lines of what we think we want to do. And this is where our thinking from the earlier part of it is, we've got to imagine people who don't actually want to spend their entire time in a Starbucks. We have to imagine other ways of living and let that develop perhaps in different places in different ways. So we then have worked out something which is defining the character of what each area should be. To acknowledge the political lines in this, I would suggest that this was put to local people to say, if you'd like to participate in this, you can put forward what you imagine this area is going to be. So we set a developed capacity for about 20 years for each high street. Then we have a carrot where we say, everything's up for grabs within this area. You can build to that capacity. And we're going to give a special express line for 8 homes or fewer, which is going to allow more developers to come into it, not just the large-scale housing developers, and that we assist people in coming up with those planning applications. That's the carrot. The planning applications, of course, have to be in conformity with the ideas and most of the legislation. The stick is the planning consent is conditional on its getting started and being completed within a set period of time. This is to overcome the problem of land holding and to see that building is built now rather than 20 years for our grandchildren. Furthermore, the landowner will lose full benefit of development if it is not completed to the agreed timetable. Bang. When the capacity is reached, other sites in the High Street area lose their potential for development. So that there is a real gamble here about whether you want to play at all or whether you're going to lose everything. It's a great thing, which I'm sure the game would then commence and people would think of ways of doing it. Now, I must mention, in parallel, planning permissions for the areas between high streets would not be entertained. Bang. No. There would be a premium for the use of those for other uses, such as allotments or making energy or recreational uses and the likes. Of course, you could stay there, but you just wouldn't be able to expand your house. Now, this is clearly a sort of fantasy, but I think it starts to point out something where we begin to realize that there are alternatives, there are different ways that people want to live, that people can define places which have an identity, they can then participate in it, you can play the gamble about how you're going to see that you work on things. It's consistent with Crispin's incredibly interesting idea of sort of community groups doing things. And it works on a main basis of making a local economic center in each of these high streets. So that's my modest suggestion on how we deal with the suburbs in the future.
Thank you very much, Fred. I feel from what you said, Fred, that it was a very generous contribution from somebody who is a sort of unrepentant metropolitan figure. And I kind of, the things that I felt were interesting from that sort of perspective were your mention of houses with gardens, for example, because that is not a typology that people who believe in an urban renaissance are advocating. So I think that's very interesting, and it does merge the two sides of the table to some degree, I think. I also think that, linking back to something Ed said, the idea of asking people is a very important thread, so that, you know, whatever solutions that we may think are going to be wonderful for everybody, you know, we've been there before with suggestions of what some people think would be good for other people. And I think it's a great idea that we can genuinely ask people what they would like to have in their areas and how they could see the future of their areas. And I think the whole thing of neighbourhood plans is very interesting, untested, largely untested ground for the future. And I think the final thing that I thought was very interesting from my own perspective as a small developer is the possibility of small developers being involved in that. Because I do think one of the things that's happening in the city is that big developers, who we all know about, are making these things which I've heard described as nano-cores, which are areas of highly dense development, which are effectively closed to the rest of the city. And they don't seem to have a lot of urban charm to them. Mm. So thank you very much, Fred. Can we now move on to James? And he's going to tell us another tale of suburbs, which is going to be fantastic.
Thank you very much. I just sort of feel like, that's my own background. I grew up in Edgware before moving elsewhere in the London Borough of Barnet, and I now live in Shepherd's Bush, so I'm much more urban, although let's not forget Shepherd's Bush used to be very much suburban. I'm going to talk about what we can learn about the future of London suburbs and what was already being built. I've chosen to focus on the London Borough of Barnet. That's where it is, for those of you who don't know. It's because it typifies much of suburban London. It's made up of 33.5 square miles of parks, gardens, houses, flats, offices and high streets. I'll be looking in particular at two areas which, to my mind, illustrate the extremes of British suburban development over the past century. First is Hampstead Garden Suburb, down to the right there, and the second is Graham Park. Hampstead Garden Suburb was built between 1909 and 1936, haven of peace and tranquility. Really very, very nice. It fits your suburban dream. Neat hedges, middle-class affluence. The second, 3.5 miles northwest, is the Graham Park Estate, completed in 1971, a notorious drug-riddled, high-crime, low-income estate. Today, it's undergoing comprehensive development and redevelopment. So, not a pretty place, but it's all going to be knocked down in the next 2 years. Now, our story starts not in Barnet or even North London, but in the East End, in Whitechapel. So that's Whitechapel in 1881. It was here in the 1870s that the ideas that led to the creation of the Hampstead Garden Suburb were being dreamed of. Henrietta Barnett, that's her, the wife of a Whitechapel vicar, was appalled by the living conditions of the urban poor she saw all around her. bad sanitation, overcrowding and disease were rife. There was no escape from the black soot of the city and neighbouring space. And so with the zeal of any right-minded Victorian social reformer, she set about creating a brave new world. She founded Toyngible, a place for university students to live while they undertook social work. She was instrumental in local initiatives such as the new Whitechapel Art Gallery, as well as the Children's Holiday Fund and the Works Educational Association. But she wanted more, to create a better place for people to live, to literally lift people out of the slums. Barnes' dedication and determination led her to conceive the Canterbury Garden suburb, and her own singular character and vision informed its design. Henrietta's project was part of a wider garden city movement pioneered by Ebenezer Howard and assembled in 1998, Tomorrow After Real Reform. This was reprinted 4 years later as Garden Cities of Tomorrow. And this is one of his diagrams on the garden city. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but it's an incredibly separate city. We have an urban centre with museum, hospital, library, theatre, concert hall, town hall. That park is about a mile across, just to give you some idea of the scale. And the one other thing that's quite modern about this is you can see it says Crystal Palace next to Fifth Avenue, just next to the Central Park. That was a circular covered shopping arcade that was planned to run throughout the city. Quite a modern idea for the time. The Garden City with, this is another diagram, this also shows his ideas about getting this mix between town and country, that we would have this perfect environment where the best of country and the best of town would be combined in this town and country mix that he was proposing. The Garden City with clear separation between areas for work and home was designed as an antidote to the grim factory towns that developed during the period, taking its inspiration from the work of industrialists such as Cadbury Bourneville, and legal brothers at Port Sunlight to build healthy communities for their employees. Howard's book stressed the importance of gardens and green spaces, which he claimed would eliminate many of the ills of industrial Britain. The first Garden City was built in Letchworth in 1983. Its architect Ray Nolan was then invited by Henrietta Barnett to build a new utopia in Leafy Hampstead. Today, this 800-acre site features some of the best urban architecture in the country. The houses are beautiful and desirable. Peter Manton, Jonathan Ross, and Sacha Baron Cohen all lived here. Lord Winston, resident of the pioneer of IDF, describes it as a unique part of London that provides a peaceful and natural haven in our bustling and exciting city. The journalist Martin Bell says that moving to the suburb was one of the best decisions I ever took. But let's hop in our luxury 4x4, an essential part of life in this wealthy suburb, and take a short drive just 10 minutes up Daymond to the other side of Barnet to visit the Grand Park Estate. It is also a descendant of Ebenezer Howard's ideas on the Garden City, with a dash of Le Corbusier thrown in for good measure, modernist concrete, high-density blocks of flats, which are originally connected by walkways in the sky in the centre of the park. Now, it's interesting to see that the pictures on the left are the garden suburb, and the pictures on the right are Graham Park. And so we've got a church. In fact, there's two churches in both of these, one free church and one a Protestant church in the suburb, and a Catholic and a Protestant church in Graham Park. And the suburb is actually, the house on the suburb is riddled with walkways, so you don't have to get run over by cars. And so another idea is carried across the Graham Park, where you're going under underpasses and lots of green space in the suburb that's open and accessible. Although the green space in Graham Park on the right, you can see I've focused in on the padlock that prevents the residents accessing it in case they don't make proper use of it. So you can just look at the grass, really, rather than actually make use of it. They also, interestingly enough, have very poor public transport. Hertzland Sullivan has a minibus that comes 3 times an hour, and Graham Park has 2 buses that solve the bus station. They pass through the estates. But there are key differences too. One suburb is designed to look like an old English village. The other was modelled on rational and modernist architecture. One has tennis courts and well-tended allotments to fill up your leisure time. The other has access to cut-price booths, counter service only. I don't know if you've ever been to one of these off-licences. You can't actually go in and pick up your beer. You get served at a window, and the man fetches it and brings it to you. You have to pay for it before you get it out. It's not a very pleasant place to be, the whole of the estate. At some point, some of us might want to get back into the 4x4 with the seated seats and head back to Hampstead. Because if we were to judge the success of these urban morphologies by the prosperity of their residents or the beauty and veneration of their built environment, then Hampstead Garden Suburb provides a clear and simple answer. This is the blueprint for a bright suburban future. But what happens when we start to ask questions about what the suburb should be, or what the purpose of the city really is, or the interrelationship of the two? Let's go back to Ebenezer Howard, the architect and visionary of the Garden City. He defined the perfect double city as limited in size to 32,000 people. But he never saw any contradiction in how he came to his conclusions, because Howells developed his ideas not in some bucolic corner of rural England, but in London, which at the time, the late 1800s, had a population of 4 million. It was the scale of London that I would argue made it possible for Ebenezer Howells to develop contacts with other like-minded social reformers, to be inspired by the radical ideas of William Morris and John Ruskin. The same contradiction lies at the centre of the original utopia imagined by Thomas More. There's the man. His ideal city, ordered, spacious and rational, was born out of medieval London with its dense, intimate connected streets, chaotic layout and bustling connections to other urban centres. Early 16th century English universities knew what was happening in Padua, Paris and Siena. More's world was a connected one, and London was a global centre for travel and exchange, for ideas and goods to be traded. It is the sheer proximity and sheer variety of ideas that makes cities the vibrant places they are. That was true then and it's true now, and it's this socio-economic engine fired by key intellectual and interpersonal relationships that forms the bedrock of urban life, because it's from this that commerce flourishes, where new ideas are generated and friendships created. This is the city, a socio-economic engine fueled by human endeavour. Cities need this human network, and they need it to be built, I would argue, in a complex, disorganised and brilliantly chaotic urban fashion. So while Moore's utopia with its six-hour working day and uniform dress code programme might have been ordered and manageable, it was also like to be exactly as Bertrand Russell described it, intolerably dull. So much for the city, but what then is a suburb? Often the answer has been a place away from the city with the benefits of the country and green space, separate from the jobs and the nasty business of commerce. This separation of people from the city, from the social and economic life that makes cities work, is the defining character of both our examples, Amsterdam suburb and Grand Park. Detachment and separation of work, play and living space are set in stone in the principles of the Garden City movement and in Le Corbusier's modernist take on the city. So that's a coloured version of the diagram I showed you before. You can see these great swathes of green separating the factories that are running around the periphery of the city. And the factory is different green, but one's a jam factory and I think another one's a corset factory. And they run around, and then you've got housing, you've got this Grand Avenue, which is about 1,000 metres across, and then you've got the shopping district. So if you wanted to go in, you've got to, provided it's not raining, it might not be too bad, but I wouldn't like to walk through the city in the cold. And this is slightly more probably famous than this is Le Corbusier's take on the modern city. Hugely separated, with massive green spaces separating all the buildings, and very clearly zoned. I haven't got a coloured version of this, I'm sorry. Sorry?
Neither did he.
There were some people of colour on the internet, but it wasn't very good, so I didn't steal it. The suburbs we've created as a result can be called anti-cities. They do not foster the key human network that makes great cities. Graham Park failed as a suburb, not because it was ugly. There are plenty of successful and ugly developments in the States. It failed because it became detached from the city, caught in a vicious circle of isolation. Its social housing was populated by the least affluent. Its internal structure made it threatening and unable for crime. It was designed without commercial opportunities for residents and the population with poor resources and limited access to transport was unable to take advantage of the surrounding city. Its residents became stuck. But our other example, Hampstead Garden Suburb, much beloved by its residents, is also stuck. It has two Grade 1 listed buildings and 740 Grade 2 listed buildings. The entire 800 acres is subject to one of the strictest and most comprehensive conservation orders in London. You cannot paint your window frames or put up a climbing frame or shed in your garden without permission. An overgrown hedge is subject to mandatory trimming, enforced by the Hampstead Garden Suburb Trust, or as I like to call them, the hedge police. And Hampstead Garden Suburb is, like its near neighbour Grand Park, also isolated and cut off from the rest of the city. Public transport is limited to a 4 times an hour minibus. Bertrand Russell's verdict on utopias, that they were intolerably dull, seems to ring out in the central square. So this is bang in the middle of the suburb, what you're looking at. Yeah. The square is made up of two churches, one girls' grammar school, and a building that once housed the Hampstead Garden Suburb Institute. The vast majority of residents have absolutely no reason to go there. The Institute, by the way, was one of the core principles of Henrietta Barnett's vision for the suburb, about learning and self-improvement. This is now moved to nearby East Finchley to be near a tube station so that people can actually use it. If the business of educating your mind takes centre stage in Henrietta Barnett's Garden Suburb, then the messy business of spending money is relegated to the fringes. Shops will place right up in the top middle where it says marketplace, and the central square is sort of centre left, and you can see it. And so that's the suburb as it is remains today. It's a busy character, it's dual carriage rate, which wouldn't be most people's first choice for where to have a morning cappuccino. So that's the picture of it up there in the top right. It's not a particularly nice shopping street. From not knowing your neighbour to not being able to buy a newspaper or a pint of milk without getting into your 4x4, places like Hampstead Garden Suburb isolate people from each other and the wider city. This upper middle class ghetto separates the people who live there from the benefits of city living, devoid of a pub, shop or cafe at its centre. It's almost impossible to engage in any socio-commercial activity within its bounds. And the suburb lives parasitically off the successful and much more mixed suburbs nearby, bolstering Temple Fortune and Highgate. On this map, you can see Temple Fortune's marked in the top left, Goldstone's bottom left there, and the bottom right off would be Highgate. The northern boundary of the suburb is golf courses, and so is the western boundary, so you can't really go anywhere from there, you have to get in your car and drive. Without these surrounding places, our leafy suburb would be a failure. It is this location that makes it work. Let's do a thought experiment and lift Hampstead Garden Suburb from London and surround it, not with a series of thriving urban villages, but with more of the same, endless sea of Tudor beat and monotony, row upon row of residential space with neatly manicured gardens, no cinema, no restaurant, no corner shop, and one suspects no celebrities, but a lot of out-of-town shopping centres and even more cars. We can see it for real when we look at Britain's post-war new towns and the suburban developments being built as we speak on the periphery of London. Were it not for its unrivalled context, I doubt very much if Hampstead Garden Suburb would be the middle-class haven and beacon of prosperity it is today. Certainly it's not a model for what we'd want to see mirrored across the country. And what are the lofty ideas of Henrietta Barley, who designed her suburb to rescue the urban poor? Could anyone from Whitechapel afford to live here in the 21st century? Would they even want to? Perhaps her success in urban planning is best summed up by Edward Lutyens, the architect of Central Square, who described Henrietta as a nice woman, but proud of being a Philistine, has no idea much beyond a window box full of geraniums over which you can see a goose on a green. So much for our well-meaning Victorian. Let's hop one last time into the imaginary 4x4 and visit somewhere new. It's called Mill Hill. And it's a suburban village in northwest London. And it's not new at all. It's been here for centuries, changing and evolving, meeting the needs of its population since at least 1374 when it's first recorded. Today it's home to a minor public school, Saracens Rugby Club, the National Medical Research Centre, the UCL Physics Department Observatory, and a vibrant high street built around Mill Hill Tensing Station. It's a successful, thriving and diverse community. Yes, there are cars, but there are regular trains and buses too. People interact at the chemist and the post office. The shops are often serviced by people who live locally. There's a fish and chip shop on the high street you can buy kebabs or a piping hot cappuccino. And those who have urgent need of a cigar or a bottle of Chateau Neuf de Pape can pop into the award-winning independent wine merchant. Mill Hill has never been designed. It did not try to answer the question, what should a suburb be? It allowed people to define their own answers through supply and demand, and also, in doing so, built an integrated social and economic hub symbiotically linked to the rest of the city. Too often our utopian ideas have failed because they cannot change. They create places where the planners and designers think people should live. It's an idea rooted in the very origins of the Garden City movement and those workers' cottages at Port Sunlight and Bourneville, which define people's lives with factory work by day and the bucolic cottage near Greenfield to return to at night. This is now a completely outdated model, but its legacy survives in Graham Park, in Hampstead Garden Suburb, and in the development of countless other suburbs of the 20th century. If we're to build successful suburbs in the future, suburbs that generate their own ideas, create their own economy and are part of the city, we have to move away from the utopian answers that gave us messily sealed residential bubbles separated from the city and unable to change. Let's return to the village. Not the chocolate box village, which only looks the part, but a real village. A hub of socio-economic activity. A place to ask the question of its inhabitants, how do you want to live? An adaptable, ever-changing suburban village. Interconnected and interdependent, a place that enriches the city around it. Thank you.